going to be talking about Fab, but we are going to be talking about criminal history in Buffalo and Western New York, with an emphasis on gangsters and organized crime. Joining us in studio, we have Michael F. Rizzo, and his book, oddly enough, is Gangsters and Organized Crime in Buffalo: History, Hits, and Headquarters. And we will invite your calls, of course, as always, at 803-0930, 803-0930, star 930 on the cell phone, and 1-800-616-WBEN. Michael Rizzo, it's a pleasure to meet you. I love your book. You are great. I love you.
Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it. It's been getting some pretty interesting talk around town.
What do you think it is? Why are people so fascinated with gangsters and organized crime when we live in an era where people are constantly the victims of violent crime?
I think it still goes back to things like The Godfather. You know, people watch that. You want to be the person that can, just take care of somebody and not have to worry about consequences, I think.
Does some of it have to do with, and I don't know if this is actually true or not, but with the perceived code of honor of the old school gangsters, especially the Italian and Jewish gangsters? In the words of Bugsy Siegel, we only kill each other, that they were very careful not to to try their best not to involve outsiders or innocent bystanders.
Yeah, I think that that's a big part of it, especially with the old time mafiosi, like Stefano Magadino. Those guys lived by a code of ethics that, most people would think is a little bizarre, but it was still, if I wanted to kill you, it was usually you I went after and no one else.
The family, your family, one of your ancestors, actually came from Sicily to get away from mafia. You want to tell that story?
Briefly, my grandfather, his family, they all came from southern Sicily, and there was a lot of mafia in that area, and his father didn't want anybody getting involved in it, and pretty much told them all all of his sons to go to America. One of them ended up in Indiana and actually was bootlegging and got killed when the steel blew up.
Hmm. You talk about Sicily and Magadino and his cousin Joe Bonanno, and a whole bunch of these other gangsters seem to have been focused in Castellamare del Golfo in Sicily. Why that particular beautiful city in Sicily, whereas Joe Bonanno said you could smell the lemon groves in North Africa?
Yeah, it was. It is a very nice place. We went there on our honeymoon, and I'm not sure why. It just must have been. There was, Palermo was not far from there, and some of the other cities. So I think it was just that proximity that a lot of them happened to come from.
When did organized crime, as we think of organized crime, the guys with, the mustache Pete's, the fancy suits, the fedoras, when did it begin in Buffalo?
In Buffalo, really around the turn of the 20th century, the early 1900s, that's when, especially in what was the Canal District downtown, where people go to enjoy concerts now, that's where a lot of them were moving to. A lot of Sicilians were coming in the late 1800s, and they were congregating in that area. It became known as Little Italy, and that's pretty much where it started.
Now, there was I don't want to use his name because I'm not sure how public he is about this, but there is a very well-known businessman around town who is of Italian ancestry, who to this day has a black hand letter that was sent to one of his ancestors around the turn of the century. You want to explain what the black hand, the mano nera, was, and why it was such a danger?
They were basically extortionists. They would find usually a wealthy businessman and say, they'd send this little letter that would say, we demand $600. If you don't pay it by Friday, we're going to bomb your house or your business, whatever it would be. And most times they just paid. And it was signed with a black hand, like a stamp of a black hand or something like that.
And there actually were bombings.
Yes.
Right around the Canal District, Dante Place, around the turn of the century, thought to have been black hand in origin.
Yeah, there was definitely, and this businessman you were talking about, his family would go on to success here. So, he didn't pay, but a lot of them would pay. And there were bombings. Buffalo less so than other cities. Buffalo was lucky in the bombing sense. Other cities, Rochester over the years, Cleveland, had a lot of bombings, but Buffalo was one of those that it was not one of the preferred methods.
Now, I don't mean to be picking gnat poop out of pepper here, but what's the difference between the Black Handers and the Mafia?
I think that from what I've gathered, research, a lot of other historians seem to think that Black Handers a lot of times were just renegades. They weren't necessarily part of the organized structure. A lot of times anybody could do it. Anybody could send a letter. And I think that's what happens sometimes.
So these were just Italian immigrants preying on other Italian immigrants trying to make a fast buck. You know, there's a story out of Chicago. It just dawns on me that there's a businessman there who is basically making tons of money, Big Jim Colosimo, and he, despite his power, was threatened all the time by Black Handers, and he finally brought in his buddy Johnny Torrio from New York City, and Torrio put an end to the threats against Colosimo by ambushing and killing the Black Handers, and Big Jim was in the clear, at least until Uncle Al came to town.
Yeah, and that's the you know, the way that they had to handle things, and again, they would take care of their own that way.
In the earliest years of the Mafia, which is a Sicilian criminal society or honored society, some would say, was there a Godfather? Was there one big guy in the earliest era of Mafia in Buffalo who was the Mustache Pete?
There were two men, but really the guy who seems to be the most prominent was Joe DiCarlo. And he was the one who ran things pretty much until he died suddenly, and that's when Magadino came to town in 22.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, it's a good place to break off because, you know, those of us of a certain age, that name Stefano Magadino, I mean, I remember even as a little kid, you'd hear that name, and you know, there was something about that name. Even the name exuded power, even for those of us who weren't Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Stay with us on News Radio 930 AM and 107.7 FM WBEN. My guest in studio is Michael F. Rizzo, and his latest contribution to our historical knowledge base in Western New York is a great book, which I received earlier this week, and I've been reading it every day religiously. The problem is I'll read it, then I'll reread it, I'll read it, then I'll reread it, so I've not gone all the way through it yet because I'm still reading about some of the stuff I find most interesting. Gangsters and Organized Crime in Buffalo, History, Hits, and Headquarters. If you just do a Google search for Michael F. Rizzo, R-I-Z-Z-O, you'll have no problem getting access to the book. And Michael, we should also let people know where they can physically buy it, brick and mortar buy it.
If they can find it, all the local bookstores carry it. I will be at Barnes & Noble McKinley tomorrow, so they should have copies.
Who? What time?
2 to 4.
2 to 4, Barnes & Noble McKinley Mall. You will be signing this book. Now, this is the latest book you've written. You've also written a book on the Big Corny Mob, which nobody... Yeah. I thought I was the only person still alive who even knew about the Big Corny Mob.
No. Yeah, that came out a few years ago. That was my third book. It's called They Call Me Corny.
What were the other books?
First one was The History of Buffalo's Mayors. Then I did 998, which is the history of retailing in Buffalo. And then last fall did Buffalo's Legacy of Power and Might, photos of commercial buildings and their history.
And now we're on to criminal history, which, again, I've found people are just endlessly fascinated by it. Even in this era of rampant crime, you know, we look at the past and for some reason, it grabs us and it sucks us in. Maybe because these people are no longer a danger to us. They're safely buried 6 feet under. Right now, it's 67 at News Radio 930 AM and 107.7 FM WBEN. My in-studio guest is Michael F. Rizzo, and his book is Gangsters and Organized Crime in Buffalo, History, Hits, and Headquarters. And I've long been fascinated by this stuff and, you know, didn't know a thing about it 30 years ago and have tried to supplement or tried to erase some of that ignorance by talking with people and by reading a whole bunch of books, so at least I'd have some basic conversational skills on the topic. And our phone number is 803-0930, 803-0930, star 930 on the cell phone, and 1-800-616-WBEN. You know, Michael, there are some personalities that are transcendent in history. You think about world history, Napoleon, Julius Caesar. You think of criminal history in America, Al Capone. And you think of criminal history in Western New York, Stefano Magadino, a low-profile guy who basically had the area sewn up. Tell us about Stefano Magadino, and I know that's a very open-ended question.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, Al Capone was around for 6 years, and kids today still know who he is. This guy was around for 52 years, and yet he's still pretty much an unknown. Came from Sicily, like we talked about, stayed in the background. From most things I could gather, he usually sent his younger brother Nino out to the streets to give the information to the people. At the same time, he disliked his brother because his brother was a playboy, as he called him. Stefano was a conservative. He didn't have a girlfriend, which is very common for a lot of them. So he was an anomaly, really. He was completely different than a lot of them, but he had a lot of power.
He was not Tony Soprano. Stefano Magadino was not Tony Soprano, who's out banging everything every night, right?
No, he was completely different.
Okay, now, what I find interesting about Stefano Magadino, and as an illustration of some of the power he had, not just in Western New York, but in the criminal syndicate across America, his cousin was Joe Bonanno, the leader of one of the five families of New York City, right?
Right.
Stefano Magadino kidnapped his cousin and held him incommunicado for a long period of time and lived afterwards, as did Bonanno.
Yeah. Now, that's a story that's contentious. Mafia historians generally don't believe that he was kidnapped. They think that it was actually Bonanno set it up to avoid a grand jury testimony. But there are rumors in Niagara Falls that Bonanno was there, and he was hiding out, and people knew it. So, I mean, it's who really knows?
I don't know how you could hide a big fish like Joe Bonanno, especially in Buffalo, being so close to New York City and all those guys with the five families and the associates.
I agree. But read both sides of it, and it is possible that he did make it up just so he could avoid that. Went into hiding for a while and then came back and turned himself in. So,
of course, in his book, Man of Honor, Bonanno paints the best possible picture of himself. He, you know, according to Joe Bonanno, he was almost a saint to the Italian community, was Joe Bonanno.
Yep.
Now, Stefano Magadino, as you pointed out, came to Western New York 1922. How was he able to consolidate in an era where everybody wanted to be the top boss, not just in Buffalo, but all over the country? Everybody wanted to be the big guy. Everybody wanted the big money of Prohibition, yet Stefano Magadino was the guy who did it. How did he do it here?
Well, the best way I can figure it is that he, in Brooklyn, he was already very powerful, became known as part of this gang called the Good Killers, which was dubbed by the press, and he already had a lot of influence. So by the time he was invited to come here, which is, we believe, how it happened, when he came here, he settled in Niagara Falls, which was primarily Italian, easy for him to go in and just start to take control, and people just followed him.
What effect did Prohibition and the vast profits to be made from a product that most people wanted have on Magadino's ability to grab and consolidate and maintain power and corruption?
I think that was huge. He said that during the 20s, he was making $10,000 a week. It's about 120 grand today's dollar. So that kind of money, easy to keep people busy, keep the supplies moving. And with the waterfront in Canada right here, I think we had a prime location to do this.
We are talking with Michael F. Rizzo. His book about organized crime in Buffalo, Gangsters and Organized Crime in Buffalo, History, Hits, and Headquarters. Michael, his book is, of course, available online. He'll also be at the Barnes & Noble McKinley Mall tomorrow, 2 until 4. Did I remember the time correctly?
Yes.
Yay, I still have something of a memory left. Terrific. 803-0930 is our phone number. Star 930 on the cell phone. 1-800-616-WBEN. Closer to home. And we're talking with Michael F. Rizzo about organized crime, the mob in Buffalo, gangsters and organized crime in Buffalo, history, hits, and headquarters. We left off talking about Stefano Magadino coming from Brooklyn, 1922, basically walking into the jackpot because it was right at the beginning years of Prohibition, easy money to be made on a product a lot of people wanted. He was in an ideal position to take shipment from Canada, Niagara Falls, Buffalo, border town, Niagara River. I mean, there were skirmishes that were fought on the river. There were skirmishes fought in Lake Ontario between the Coast Guard and the various rum runners. And at what point did you begin to see, or did we begin to see, the the going legitimate, the local Magadino family and associates and members trying to go legitimate so they could document sources of income.
As soon as Prohibition ended, he had a beer distributorship. So as soon as Prohibition ended, 1933, he had a legitimate business, had an office there in Niagara Falls. And then they, in 1940, they bought the funeral home that became the Magadino Memorial Chapel. So they had legitimate businesses for many years.
What was Magadino's history with law enforcement and his rap sheet? What kind of issues did Uncle Sam give him? What kind of issues did the Phoebes give him, the FBI, the local cops?
For the most part, the only thing, he was arrested in 1921 in Brooklyn or in Avon, New Jersey, as part of a murder suspect. But other than that, locally, I think he had a lot of people working for him on both sides of the law. So there's really nothing locally. He seemed to have a very good relationship with everybody.
Was he the guy? Was he the man? Was he as close to the Godfather character written about in the Godfather series as we would ever see in Western New York?
I think so. I think that he would be that person again because he was a little different, stayed in the background more. But he would still classify as that type of character.
Now, one of the things about The Godfather, and of course this is more fiction than fact, we're not going to deal in drugs. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of these crime families, they say don't deal in drugs, but they're more than happy to take the money that comes from drugs, just don't get caught, or then you're going to be in trouble. Mm-hmm. How about the Magadino family? How involved in cocaine, heroin, and other illicit drugs was it over the years?
Well, he was one of them that said no drugs, no prostitution outwardly, but we know that there were drug dealers going back at least to the 1930s. Hard to believe that he would let money like that slip through his fingers. So I would have to believe that he knew what was going on and probably was, if he wasn't involved, he was taking something for it.
803-0930 is the phone number, *930 on the cell phone, 1-800-616-WBEN. Let's go to Linda in Cheektowaga. Linda, you are on with Michael F. Rizzo. Good morning. You've got a question?
No, I have to tell you something, Tom. Hi, Mr. Rizzo.
Hello.
I'm very nervous about this call. I wasn't going to call, but I have to call. My uncle worked for Joe DiCarlo. My family knew them very well. My dad owned a butcher shop on the west side. I don't want to say the name.
Please don't.
Mr. Rizzo. My uncle killed a man on Busty for Joe DiCarlo. I was told this, Tom. I was so mad when I was told this. I was stunned my family would have done this, and they did. This is disgusting, killing people. I'm not like that, Tom. I'm very nervous and jumpy talking about it now, as you could see in my voice.
Well, your uncle is long gone.
Oh, yes. I met Sammy the Bull at my uncle's funeral, my uncle's wake.
Sammy the Bull Gravano, at one point John Gotti's underboss, who eventually turned state's evidence and ended up putting his boss and a whole bunch of other people in jail.
Yes, I met him at my uncle's funeral. I did not know the man, but he introduced me to him, my family.
Now,
my father was well-known, my uncle, my aunt. And Joe DiCarlo has a daughter, too. My aunt was close to. I don't want to mention her name.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's a big part of today's show. Don't mention names. I mean, I'm not going to tell you the people in the book I know. Believe me.
I won't do that to you.
Yeah, as far as the crime your uncle committed, the murder on Busty, Michael, you write about that in the book, or am I mistaken?
I might have. I don't recall off the top of my head.
I remember a Busty Avenue homicide written about in the book, and I don't remember if that was one of the unsolved ones or one of the solved ones. Did your uncle ever get arrested, ma'am?
No, he didn't. See, Tom, they kept this from me till I got older, okay? I caught on a couple things. When they used to come to my dad's house and my aunt's house, they used to shove us out of the room, and these big men came in, and they had the meetings there. So I was putting two together, but I wasn't sure. I was scared to ask. But then it was told to me.
Understood. Linda, thank you actually, you've brought up a great point, maybe without even knowing it. Thank you very much for the phone call.
And my father, I could hit him in the head for dealing with those people. He did a wonderful business on the west side with the butcher shop, but And my uncle had a butcher shop. I know Mr. Rizzo knows where it was. I don't want to mention where. And Boston there, too.
All right. Thank you very much. Michael, you know, it's so interesting because that lady, I think, speaks for a lot of people listening this morning. And I know some of these people who are Italian surnamed Americans, and they are one or two generations removed from these ruthless killers. And there's a feeling of shame mixed maybe with a little bit of pride that they were able to rise above the system and make something of themselves. You're an Italian surnamed American. Doing the book, did you feel as though you were doing somehow a disservice to your ethnic forebears?
No, I mean, I find it's history. That's the way I look at it. It's history that already took place, you know, and I'm just documenting and trying to put it in order so, you know, somebody else can look at it. You know, it's not necessarily the best history of Buffalo, but it's part of our history.
Well, I have pictures of my great uncles in Nazi uniforms, and I put it at News Radio 930 AM and 107.7 FM WBEN. We're talking about organized crime in Buffalo. Gangsters and organized crime in Buffalo, history hits and headquarters. My guest is Michael F. Rizzo, the author of the book, and Michael is going to be at Barnes & Noble tomorrow, tomorrow 2 to 4 at the McKinley Mall location. His book is, I'm told, rather hard to find at bookstores. It keeps flying off the shelves and is already in its second publication. I want to throw out one of Buffalo's most notorious mob hits, and it's something that people of a certain generation are very familiar with, and people of another generation have heard about but may not know an awful lot about: Romanello's Roseland.
Yeah, that was John Camilleri. He was a made guy in Buffalo, and he called himself a labor negotiator, involved in a lot of labor things in the city, and he wanted a job with the union, and kept pestering them. He was in the press, and finally they agreed to a sit down with him, had a meeting, said no, and on his 63rd birthday he was killed outside of Romanello's after attending a wake.
He was at the restaurant, left the restaurant to go to the wake, going back to the restaurant, and he was killed right there on the sidewalk.
Yes, and from what I understand, Romanello's was, they were not very happy with that taking place outside there.
But, you know, that, it's interesting because Romanello's Roseland. I mean, you say that to a certain generation of people, and everybody gives you the same look that, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. You know, that nodding of the head and the exclamation points, yep, almost in the eyebrows.
Yeah, and then apparently, you know, as time would go on, people wanted to know where he was sitting in the restaurant, and, you know, it just became that fascination with it.
But sometimes these places that are the sites of these mob hits become almost impossible to get into because everybody wants to go there. Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. You can't get in there on the weekends.
Yeah.
Umberto's Clam House, where Joe Gallo was cut down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure, I don't know for a fact, but I'm sure that, you know, it had some type of similar effect there, too.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Let's go to Dan in Medina on WBEN. Dan, you are on. Hello.
Hey, I just got a quick question for Mr. Rizzo. Well, anyways, we came from Niagara Falls in the late 70s, and, well, cut the story short, my mom was scared about everything going on at the time, but she used to say that Mr. Meganino had a tunnel under his warehouse that went under the road to his funeral home.
Yes, I heard a lot of stories about tunnels, and he lived on Whitney Avenue in the Falls. There was supposedly a tunnel under the street there. We were doing tours in Niagara Falls, and I had a water authority person on the bus one time, and I asked him, and he said, there's no tunnel under here. There was supposedly a tunnel from his home in Lewiston that went to a parking garage.
I heard about that, too.
Yeah, so, but I've never been able to confirm any of them. I think a lot of them are more
urban myths.
Urban myths.
And maybe assigning more power to somebody than he actually had based on the mythology that surrounds them.
Yeah, it's very possible.
And was it true that they stuck him with pins when he died at a funeral?
I'm sorry, what was that?
They stuck him with pins when he died at his funeral?
If he was really dead, yeah.
I don't know about that for sure.
Yeah, from my aunt's side. I was just kind of curious. I'll have to get your book. It sounds really good.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Appreciate your call. After the death of Stefano Magadino, what happened with the Buffalo Mob? Did it splinter? Was there one top guy? How did that all work out, the battle for succession?
Well, really, after in November 68, when he was arrested, his son Peter, and who was going to succeed him, and eight others in Niagara Falls, that's when it really started to splinter. And he was only able to keep his title because he had been in power so long. But other than that, power already shifted to Buffalo, you know, not too long after that. And that's pretty much where it ended up.
And the people who took over in 68, and of course here we have to be kind of careful because we're getting into areas that could be actionable if nobody has been tried or convicted of anything. But in terms of the people who started to take power in Buffalo after 1968, are they the same people who are still in power in whatever mob remains today?
There were different factions, different people. Some of the people, as far as I know, are no longer around. So there was a succession of bosses, and there were people that have been said to be boss over the years, but nobody's ever been tried or convicted of anything.
We have a lot of things, and you have to be careful, folks, because what people think they know and what can be proven in a court of law are two different things, and I can think of at least one very famous case in Buffalo media where somebody was identified as being in organized crime. They weren't, and they walked away with millions. So, you know, I got to be careful here for the sake of the Entercom lawyers and my own career. It is coming up on 11:30 at News Radio 930 AM and 107.7 FM WBEN. It's Bowerly. My in-studio guest is Michael F. Rizzo. His book, which I have not been able to put down, Gangsters and Organized Crime in Buffalo, History, Hits, and Headquarters. Now, we've been focusing a lot so far on the Italian or Sicilian aspect of organized crime in Buffalo. Did you know that one of Buffalo's most notorious gangsters was a Polish-American? Big Corny. Next. It is 11:39 at News Radio 930 AM and 107.7 FM WBEN. You know, Michael, when I was doing some research on crime in Buffalo, by the way, this is one of those books I would love to have been able to write. Unfortunately, the time just isn't there like I thought it would be. I stumbled across a gang that I had never heard of and probably is not exactly a household name anymore, but they sure were back in the day in Buffalo, and it was a Polish-American gang known as the Big Corny Gang. What was that all about? What did they do? What was their claim to fame?
Well, John Kwiatkowski, Big Corny, he was a blonde hair, 6 foot tall, good looking guy. Him and his gang were basically payroll robbers. They would set up a robbery at a factory, bust in, and unfortunately, over the years of 25 to 29, they had several murders on their hands. And the last job they did at the old Fetters plant was finally the one that did them in.
That robbery was notorious in the annals of Buffalo crime. You want to walk us through the Fetters ripoff?
Well, basically what they did, they planned everything really well. They went in with disguises and everything. But several things, as they were walking in, the treasurer happened to notice them out of the corner of his eye, ran into the safe with the money, so they didn't get much money. In the meantime, outside, one of the an employee is fighting with one of the guys, and then they end up shooting the guy and killing him, and they're trailed by a couple bystanders who alerted the police.
A shootout ensued?
A shootout on the west side. It was a car chase, a shootout, machine guns. They're believed to be the first ones to bring a machine gun into Buffalo. And they eventually got caught, and one of them ended up in the electric chair.
Whatever happened to Big Corny himself? He eventually lived a pretty long life, did he not?
Yeah, he lived until 1964, 65. He was banned from Buffalo. So when he left prison, he ended up staying out in the Syracuse area.
I bet he's still got relatives around here.
There are some people. I've met a few of them over the years.
Michael, when you were doing this book and when word got out that you were researching the mob in Buffalo, something I learned from another local crime author is the Goombas kind of come out of the woodwork, and you know, they don't they want to know what you're up to, and sometimes they'll even help you with some details that didn't come from them. What was your experience?
A few people that I did contact were actually pretty helpful. Since the book's come out, it's been even more. I have more stories, more people coming out, you know, just more contacts. You know, there have to, might have to be an update or another book.
Once you find that you've gained their trust and you keep your word, do you find that you start getting more and more information that you could actually use in your second book, as long as you don't source it back to the people who give it to you?
Probably, yeah. So far, you know, so far everybody seems to be pretty open, and you know, like you said, as long as they trust me.
These guys have egos. They like being written about, do they not?
Probably. I mean, the few guys that I actually talked with that were involved, I'm not sure that way, but there are a lot of them. I mean, it goes back to, you know, the whole Godfather thing, how they began imitating the movie afterwards. And, you know, it's all part of that persona.
The guys with whom you have spoken and the research you've done, Buffalo's Mob, more like The Godfather or Goodfellas?
There's a little bit of everything, but I'd lean more towards The Godfather. I'm sure there was a lot of the, you know, the guys on the street, the soldiers, the associates that were, you know, those guys that were breaking into stores and, you know, stealing thousands of records back in the day, things like that, fur coats. But it was a lot of that low-level stuff, but then they had the big stuff, the bookmaking and all the other things.
You know, I just want to get back to something because I think it's important, and I didn't want to gloss over the power and the intelligence network of Stefano Magadino. Here's this guy who is running the syndicate in Western New York, and there were a couple of brothers in Lackawanna who had a little something going at the factories, a little betting operation going on. Magadino finds out about it and puts the heat on these guys to kick it upstairs, and they idiotically refuse. What's that story?
The Aquino brothers, yeah, they were doing well. They hung out on, they lived in the city. They hung out on Allen Street, and looked like they were running, you know, out of like maybe the Ford plant, Bethlehem Steel out there. A lot of people, a lot of money, and you know, when Magadino found out that they weren't paying, asked, you know, sent one of his guys to ask them to pony up some money, and they said no, they were doing good, and basically was within a couple days they both disappeared and both came up dead.
Just out of curiosity, and I don't know if you can put yourself into their headspace, but if you're independent operators and you're in Magadino's territory and his emissaries tell you that you got to kick some up to Uncle Steve and you say no, I mean, what were they thinking?
These were young guys. They were probably, you know, what was called Young Turks at the time. They probably thought that they were invincible, you know, so that's probably what the reason was.
Wow. And one of them, I mean, one of the stories I always heard as a child was about a body or bodies found on Two Mile Creek Road in Tonawanda, and I'll put this delicately, at least one of the bodies had its male genitalia in a place where you might not expect to find male genitalia except at Ellicott Creek Park.
That's a story I've heard too. I haven't been able to verify that. And, you know, hopefully, not hopefully, but it might be one of those stories that could be just one of those ones that you know, urban myth. But you never know.
Let's get back to the calls on WBEN. Here's Ken in Akron with Michael Rizzo. Hello, Ken. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. I have a comment. This really stirred up some old memories for me, especially, Tom, when you brought up the Polish mob. A lot of people don't believe me when I tell them that such a thing existed. My grandfather, I will not mention a name, but used to work at the Bethlehem Steel Plant. And when he was younger, rumor has it he was quite a nasty man, and rumor has it he definitely was part of that Polish mob. There's been situations when my father and my uncle and aunt were younger. He'd get calls in the middle of the night. He would disappear for 2-3 nights at a time. And he was also associated with an uncle of mine who owned a small chain of candy stores in the area. And that's where they used to conduct their business. And there was at one time my great-grandfather, who owned property, was a farmer out in the southern tier somewhere in the country. There have been two occasions where my grandfather had brought burlap bags with handguns in them, and his instructions were to get rid of those handguns. And it was quite a deal. And I guess what ended everything at that particular time is my grandfather had a gambling problem. And the last time he was known to associate with those people was he was delivered on the doorstep, beaten half to death, telling my grandmother, don't ever let them go out and spend the money anymore. Otherwise, we'll deliver them in parts as opposed to a half-beaten up body.
Oh, that's like almost like the last scene of The Public Enemy with James Cagney.
I just when you brought it up, it just sends shivers down my spine. But I find it very interesting because it is part of my family history.
Well, you will enjoy the book, sir, and I'm glad you called in.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Are you getting? We've got a break coming up from CBS, so hold on WBEN. AccuWeather for today, cloudy, some rain, 73 the high. Tonight, Bison's Friday night bash against Charlotte, clearing skies. Might see some rain in the southern tier, 63. Tomorrow, sunny to partly cloudy and nice, 80. Right now, down to 66 at News Radio 930 AM, 107.7 FM, WBEN. Let's go to John in Buffalo with Michael Rizzo. Hello.
Good morning. I was just wondering if you heard about the Coulihanning painting heist in the late 60s, early 70s in Bradford, Pennsylvania, and the Buffalo connection, if it was mob-related.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
Got to get your mic on.
I think I know which one that was. It ended up being tied to some Buffalo guys.
Yes, I know, because I grew up on the West Side, and I knew the family, and I won't say any names, but I did see the paintings in the basement before the FBI had raided the house.
Yeah, nice.
Wow. All right. Thank you very much. I want to shoot some names at you. No pun intended here, because obviously some of their families are still alive, and, it's just a figure of speech. But some names, and I believe some of these homicides are unsolved. Number one, Peter Piccolo.
Yep.
Talk about a well-known name in Buffalo, and I was stunned to find his name. And I'd forgotten all about Peter Piccolo. What was his story?
He was, a very popular entrepreneur, hairstylist, school, everything going on, and found him dead in his building over on Elmwood and Allen. And it's believed that it was drug-related, exactly how that came about. But it was definitely two bullets to the head or whatever it was.
And in what way was he connected? Was he in the mob? Was he an associate? Was he somebody who welched on a deal?
Originally they thought it was a financial thing and somebody took care of him for that. But two stories I've heard. One is that when he was dealing cocaine. Another one that he might have been dealing it to a mobster's daughter. So either way, those are the stories that I have. Neither one of them points to a good outcome, obviously.
Billy Shalino,
mm-hmm.
Unsolved.
Yeah, that was one that was, he was working on the rapid transit construction, and guys caught him in a trailer and opened fire and killed him. It was, I think, kind of a surprise at the time, but that's one that. One of the most recent ones that comes up every once in a while.
What was the motive? And I've heard various things, various possible motives in the shooting and the murder of Billy Shalino. What's the best guess?
The one that I've heard from several different people is that he was an informant, that he had been arrested for something and he was talking. Some people claim that he wasn't, but several people close to the situation said yes.
One of the major stories of the 1950s and one of the biggest organized crime stories ever, Apalachin and the bust at Apalachin and the Buffalo connection.
Magadino at the time was pretty much the head of the Mafia Commission, approved this meeting, and he wasn't found when the state police stumbled across it, so some people thought it was a setup by him. It was big. It was at least a half a dozen local guys, including John Montana, who was owner of Van Dyke Taxi at the time, and he was one of the only people that didn't plead the Fifth Amendment whenever they had questioning.
Joe Valachi, buried where?
In Lewiston. Yeah, he had a girlfriend in Niagara Falls. They met years ago, and after he went to into hiding down in Texas when the government took care of him, when he died, his family didn't claim his body, so she claimed it and brought it up to Lewiston.
Well, I so many more questions and things I'd like to discuss with you. I guess that only means we're going to have to get you back, Michael. I'm sorry, but I might have to invite you back to the show again. Your book, now you physically tomorrow, you will be at Barnes & Noble, McKinley Mall from 2 until 4, signing your book, Gangsters and Organized Crime in Buffalo, History, Hits, and Headquarters. I know it's also available for Nook and Kindle users.
Correct. And I will be downtown at the Central Library next Wednesday, 12 to 1 also, and there should be copies available there.
Well, that's outstanding. And based on the phenomenal success of this book, will there be a second? Will there be a second? Please let there be a second.
It's only a month out. Give me a little time to recover.
Well, don't wait too long. Michael Rizzo, thanks so much for joining us in studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this morning's show. I obviously am sorry that we had the tragedy taking place in Colorado. We talked about that extensively and exclusively the opening part of the show. Then we went a little bit more local as we interspersed things with the CBS updates from Colorado. The Rush Limbaugh Show comes up next, thanks to Chris Johnson and Joe Beamer at Master Control and call screening duties. The noon news is next.